listening to Studio 809 Podcasts. This is what community sounds like.
We've got a lot to say, so let's do this.
So welcome, good afternoon, to the League of Women Voters of the Pikes Peak Region, our community conversation, which is on growth, planning for the future of Colorado Springs. I'm Shelley Roars, your spokesperson for our local league, and your host today. This event is always open to the public. We try to have our monthly meetings on the third Saturday of every month from 1 to 3, so that's consistent for you. Some months are not always that way, but most of the time it is. We are open to the public, and we do appreciate, again, you taking the time to be an engaged citizen on a beautiful Saturday afternoon, whether you're here in person, in the Columbine Room A, at the Penrose Library, or joining us virtually via Zoom. If you don't know, the League is a group of community leaders working to improve our systems of government and impact public policies through education and advocacy. League positions are usually in three areas: voter education and outreach, good government, and citizens education. Some know us as LWVPPR, and we are a nonpartisan grassroots organization. Today's topic falls under two categories: good government. I think city planning and growth in Colorado Springs falls under good government. And obviously, citizens education. You're here to learn about what we're doing. So thank you to our members and our volunteers for helping out today. Christine is on technology. Thank you. Brenda over here also on technology. Anna, Paulita, Molly, thank you all for being here and welcoming everybody. And Dave over in Studio 809 is helping with our podcast recording. So you'll be able to hear this even if you are not here today. You'll be able to get some good information at our website, and of course, studio809podcast.com. Just an FYI for you, our annual meeting for the league is on Saturday, April 23rd from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Sand Creek Library. By the way, that's not just league members. That is an open meeting to the public. Our guest speaker, we always usually have a guest speaker, and I believe that is our Secretary of State, Jenna Griswold, is our guest speaker this time. So that is open to the public if you're interested in that. If you need anything, again, go to lwvppr.org for more of our upcoming events and information about us. So as we introduce our guests, both of them are planners with the City of Colorado Springs. Both just happen to be women. Yay for us. So please welcome Morgan Hester, who is the planning supervisor, and Hannah Van Nimwegen McGuire. And she is a senior comprehensive planner with the city. So welcome, ladies. Thank you so much. You are both members of AICP. One of you want to tell us what that is?
AICP is a professional planning certification. So it is the American Institute of Certified Planners.
Yeah, so the AICP certification is a test that several city planners, or most city planners, should take at some point in their career. And it focuses on the ethics of being a local government planner and dealing with some pretty hot topics and how to handle those ethically.
First, thank you for having us this afternoon on a Saturday. Hannah and I get very excited to talk about planning, and we will adjust our microphones accordingly so that we're not blasting anybody's eardrums. Both of us have been planners for quite some time. As mentioned, we work for the City of Colorado Springs. Both of us have worked for other jurisdictions in the past, so we do have some experience in other settings, which is just adding to what is helpful, a good solid foundation and knowledge for what we currently focus on. I do want to say that today's presentation will be focused on what we're calling Planning 101, so kind of the basics of planning, and we do get into specifics for the processes that we have here, but we don't do development review, so we will not be able to answer questions about specific projects. I just kind of wanted to put that out there. Both of us focus more on long-range planning type situations and projects, which we will discuss with you today. So our goal is to talk about history of planning and basics. What is a comprehensive plan? How does Plan COS play into that? And what is zoning, our general process here, and how you can get involved in public participation with the Springs? It's important to understand the basics of planning, kind of getting that perspective that it's not something that is so much made up with each jurisdiction or municipality. So planning has been, and this is something, the initial question with what is AICP, a lot of this is part of the basic understanding of planning, and some of this does show up on AICP. Not saying that you could all become certified planners after today, but if you could be, then we would call it a success. The history of planning, a lot of this stems from Industrial Revolution and the need for the protection of the general health, safety, and welfare of the public. So putting in systems, including sanitation, the separation of uses, recognizing that there's a need for light in housing and crammed quarters with multiple families in the same unit is kind of difficult and not really something that everyone is striving for when they think of their day-to-day and where they want to live and how they want to live. So those things that were becoming sort of recognized in the 1800s, that did stem into the history of planning and wanting to figure out ways to create safer living environments for everyone, not just housing, but recognizing that you really don't want to live next to a factory in your crammed housing quarters, given not everybody had those situations, but that is something that really stemmed how planning was viewed in the United States. And from there, jumping ahead probably 100-ish years, talking about zoning. So this is something that stemmed from, again, recognizing the fact that there needed to be the separation of different use types. In the early 1900s, the city of LA did implement some regulations for how development would occur and how those uses would be or would not be compatible with one another. And when I say uses, I'm referring to something like residential or commercial or industrial. Where are those parks going to be located? So LA was kind of cutting edge in a sense with that. A few years later, New York City implemented their first zoning law and regulations and focusing again on how the separation of uses would be enacted and enforced within a huge metropolitan area. The city of Colorado Springs first implemented a zoning regulation in 1926. So whenever in our department there is something, and I'm just going to get into like a little bit of process here, but for a lot of the older homes and older areas that were maybe developed prior to being the actual city of Colorado Springs, because we do have many neighborhoods that are reflective of that history. Some of the development pattern was, I'm going to put a house here and a house here and just kind of develop it how it feels good. And, you know, there's not compliance with dimensional standards, which would include something like setbacks or building height or lot coverage, what we currently have codified in our zoning code. So the development pattern was more reflective of how things were being done historically and what your neighbor did and what, again, kind of just felt right for where you are. We will get applications in our department that are called legal nonconforming letters or zoning verification letters, which is reflective of the fact that, hey, I recognize the fact that I have a property. I'm not so sure that it really meets what is currently codified in the zoning code. And we do refer to the first zoning code that was enacted again in 1926 because there were a lot of developments that had come in prior to, so they were not subject to those zoning regulations. But just wanting to put that out there because we have a lot of those stepping stones and benchmarks in the history of Colorado Springs that we as planners have to be very mindful of in the fact that not everybody is going to have developed as more of a suburban type style, focusing specifically with residential with this example, of course. But also what happened in 1926, so, and this was reflective of a Supreme Court case, the village of Euclid, Ohio, there was a lawsuit, a situation where there was maybe some hostility between property owners and the argument of, is this use really okay to be adjacent to this use? And I'm very much watering this down, but wanting to get to, so Village of Euclid, I don't know if anybody is familiar with historic planning type Supreme Court cases. If you are, I'm very impressed. Again, you could take the AICP exam, but Euclidean zoning is something that we will refer to in our department that can be kind of rephrased to where it's essentially exclusionary zoning. So you have very specific uses, residential, commercial, industrial. There's not much of a crossover and there's not mixed use. So it's Euclidean in nature. That's what we refer to that as. Again, it's exclusionary because you're excluding other use types from residential. So it's not permissive to have a corner store. Nope, you can have a single family house and that's how the zoning has been outlined. There are a number of theories that evolved in the history of planning, focusing on, you know, at one time we had grid-like streets and there was a lot of housing. It was very vertical, putting in a number of people in those housing units. But then there was the thought of, could we make this beautiful and something that is truly enjoyed? You know, you can go outside and go to a park. So you started to see these more curvilinear streets, green space was dedicated, there was parkland, so that when people were residing in their homes, there was something that, yes, provided visual interest, but also recognized the need for being outside and having that experience with nature. Going back to what I had mentioned earlier, recognizing the general health, safety, and welfare, those are some proven things, green space and being outside and enjoying yourself, that humans really need whenever they're interacting with the built environment. And so it lists some different theories: city beautiful, monumental design, garden city, garden suburb, and new urbanism. All of those rooting in the need for having that landscaped green space, park space available, but also where we are kind of now-ish is the new urbanism thought that having a mix of uses and walkability and this concept of eyes on the street. So there's a lot of interaction, again, with the built environment. So these things have evolved over multiple decades, but they're still ringing true that these are things that people want whenever they are looking for a place to live, not just in their specific neighborhood, but maybe a city as a whole. Housing, there were a lot of things that occurred in the 1900s with housing, multiple bills that were passed, focusing largely on urban renewal, comp planning, model cities, HUD. There are all these things that as time went on, again, recognizing the fact that how we did this in the past maybe is not great for the future, that cramming in a lot of people, or recognizing the fact that not everyone can afford housing. And, you know, how can we, from the federal government standpoint, how can we impact this nationally and ensure that there are things that are in place from the governmental perspective that we can assist with, again, using housing as this example with HUD. How can we make an impact with that? Because it's always going to evolve. We're going to recognize that we could do better with what we've got. And that is reflective in all of these different housing acts and bills that came forward. Comprehensive planning. So in 1928, through the Standard City Planning Enabling Act, needing to have something that, yes, we have zoning. So that's the separation of uses and what you can do with your property, but a comprehensive plan, what is the vision? What are the goals for a city? That was implemented at the national level. And so you will see that there are many jurisdictions, some who are required by state law, have to have a comprehensive plan. Colorado Springs does have a comprehensive plan, and we use that as somewhat of the umbrella for what we should enact as planners and what regulations we have in place. The comprehensive plan is somewhat of our guiding document. What is zoning? Because I know that it is a conversation, especially now with some projects that we have going on, but what is the purpose of it? So if we didn't have zoning, it could just be kind of like a willy-nilly, I'm going to put stuff here, I'm going to put stuff there. There are cities in this country that do not have zoning, and Houston being one of them. They do manage development through deed restrictions and other processes, but the majority of the country has zoning enacted within their municipalities, and it will define what you can or cannot do with your property. So if you have something that is zoned for multifamily development, you most likely cannot build a factory on that property. You'd have to look for a different zoning district. What are the dimensional standards? So anything, not really anything, but I do in a general sense say anything that you can assign a number to could be found in zoning code. So what is your front yard setback? Is it 20 feet? Is it 25 feet? If you're building maybe a coffee shop, how many parking spaces do you need based on that use? How many shrubs should you put into your development? All of these things being required, again, going back to that concept of the protection of the general health, safety, and welfare of the public, those mechanisms are in place for a reason. It's not to be just totally restrictive and we don't want anyone to enjoy what they're doing. Having a certain number of parking spaces is required because we want to ensure that it's not going to put a burden on an adjacent property or the public right of way. So if you have a store, you may have very different parking requirements, like a Target on Christmas, which is kind of always the example that we use, versus the library. Knowing that this is a public facility, so it's civic, and the colors that I have on this side of the screen is reflective of what those uses are. So knowing that, wow, Target is going to be really, really popular at this time of year, this time of day, we're going to have 100 parking spaces versus maybe 10 or something for an office type use. So I mentioned dimensional and development standards, and something that we want to share with the masses that if there is a property zoned for a certain district commercial, and there maybe this is at a four-way intersection and each corner is zoned commercially. So a lot of you are probably thinking it's most likely going to be a gas station. Those types of uses are permitted in that zone district. And if there's a request that comes in, let's say there are ice cream shops. You have three ice cream shops on three of those corners. The fourth corner has the same zoning designation. We could think, this seems really silly. There's a lot of ice cream shops here. If it's compliant, the application is compliant with all other zoning requirements, so they're showing the adequate parking, landscaping, they meet all of the setbacks and building height, et cetera, we cannot deny that request. That's a legal issue. Would probably set ourselves up for a lawsuit, which honestly, I would somewhat hope so, because you cannot do that. But making that point, because the zoning, again, is establishing what the development pattern will look like. Is everything appropriate? Probably not. And in the findings that staff works through, making sure does it truly meet everything in our code, we can make the argument that it doesn't really make sense for these reasons. And then presenting that to a higher review body so that they make that decision. That is the role of a planner. But just wanted to kind of make that point as we're talking about what zoning is. And we do have zoning. The city has a code of ordinances, which is filled with all regulations for city. So chapter 6 is things that code enforcement uses. You know, how many pets can you have? Can you have goats on your property? Chapter 2 is for the city clerk. What does it look like when you're wanting to do business licensing? Chapter 7 is the zoning and subdivision ordinance. So for anybody who's coming in with a request and they say, I want to subdivide this property, regulations for what that looks like can be found there. What is permitted in the zone district, that is all found there as well. So what I have here on the left side is a list of what our processes look like. And on the right side of the screen is a triangle showing how we build up from the bottom to the top. Specific to Colorado Springs, well, really anywhere, I want another point that I would love to make clear. Planning staff does not have control over what applications are submitted. So we, as planning staff, are not seeking out new developments. We are not reaching out to a bowling alley and saying, hey, this area is very underserved with bowling alleys. I don't know how I even gave that example. We're not trying to pull in the business. If someone wants to propose a bowling alley, that's great. Thank you for your submittal. We'll review it based on our zoning and subdivision ordinance. Does the zoning allow for it? Where's your building, parking, your landscaping? What's the building look like? Those kinds of things. That is what we do. Some economic development departments in various municipalities will seek out developments and new businesses to come into their city. We do that here. I've worked for other places who quite aggressively will make trips across the country and they'll try to pull in new businesses. But just, again, want to be clear that planning staff largely don't have any impact on what applications come in. So there could be waves where things are really popular. We get a whole bunch, I'm just going to keep using ice cream shops. We get a lot of ice cream shops for 6 months and then we don't get any more because the market's kind of saturated and then it'll be the new thing. So just kind of wanting to make that point before I get into this. The first level that we have, again, kind of the umbrella is the comprehensive plan, which is Plan COS. And we will discuss that more in our presentation, but looking at the comprehensive plan. And then on top of that, we have zoning, and then it's kind of annexation might fall in that category as well, because if the land is not currently within city limits, it needs to be in city limits so that they can comply with our regulations. And then we have zoning, and then a development plan, which is showing the building footprint, parking, landscaping, all of the things that are going to be built on that property. Platting, so that's the legal subdivision of a property, and that is recorded with the city clerk. It's the only document that we record with them. So it's like, the official showing where your lot corners are and where the streets are and what that configuration is. And then we have permits. So if there's someone wants to do a block party, we would require a temporary use permit, for example. So there's a very methodical way that all of this works from the bottom up or top down, you know, depending on what the application is. So I did kind of go through all of that. Oh, and I forgot, we do have variances also. So let's say that there's a development and they're not in full compliance for whatever reason. Maybe there's some sort of topography on site that doesn't allow for them to meet what regulations we have in place. They could seek a variance and use that as the reasoning that I can't make this work because of the conditions of the site. And then we would review that and make sure that it's not going to have a negative impact on the property or adjacent properties or however that really looks, depending on the situation. Working for the government, whatever level is of that it is, federal, state, or local, there are a lot of hoops that not only applicants have to jump through, but we do as well. So we may have a vision for what we would like to see, but as a government employee, have to be compliant also with those regulations, just as the applicant is. And we do have the ability to make changes with comprehensive plans or neighborhood planning, which Hannah will go over. But kind of a note that if there's something up here and you read a book and you think, why are we not doing that? I feel ya. But there are just things that, depending on the pattern of development, and a lot of these books are written in sort of like a utopian type mentality that if everything were perfect and we had a blank slate to work off of, this is what we could do. From a planner's perspective, there are times that we wish it'd be so cool if we could start our own city, and then there are all these things that we could do. But this is a big one, how to get involved with the public process. I recognize the fact that we do this all day, every day, and so it's very different than what just my husband's perspective. You know, there he'll have questions about stuff, and I want to present this to you all that we live together and he still has questions. How can you get involved in the public process? If you receive a green postcard that says, hey, there's a new project going on, you have received that because you are within 1,000 feet of the subject property that is under discussion. So maybe it's a new development. Maybe there's a variance. There could be a number of things going on. Read through that postcard. The contact information for the planner, who is the project manager, will be on there. There will also be maybe like 3-ish bullet points giving a brief summary of what that project is. So read that. We know that they all look the same, which can be kind of confusing if you're maybe in a hot spot where there's always development going on, but read through that list and see what it is. And then you can reach out to the planner if you have further questions, or if you're super excited that there's another ice cream shop coming in, or if you think, are you kidding me? There's another ice cream shop. We want to hear the positive and the negative. We feel like with most projects, the thought is, oh, if I'm opposed, I'm going to let them know. No, please tell us if it's something that you're excited about. And that's not just coming from the human perspective where someone else is not loving this, which we understand. But really, if there's something that you're excited about, share that information with us. We have had some situations come up recently where we have some participants who have been upset that their information is included in the overall agenda packet for Planning Commission or City Council. So I want to let you all know, if you do send in an email, we keep all of that. That's part of the public record, and that will be included in the agenda packet. So that includes your email address, and not that anybody's ever going to add you to an email list, but it is public information at that point. So if that makes you a little uncomfortable, you can absolutely call in. You could mail in a letter versus emailing it in. Or if you do want to continue to email, maybe not including your address on there. Just some tips if that does make anybody uncomfortable. Part of my role is the neighborhood liaison for development. So I serve as a neutral party. I don't do development review. So when applications come in, I'm not reviewing and presenting them to City Planning Commission and or City Council. My focus is more on policy. So it'll be code amendments or those types of things. How do we make change with our regulations? If there's a situation that comes up where you think, oh, I don't know, I've talked to the planner and I don't feel like they're hearing me, that's where I come in. So you reach out to me, and this is my email address. So morgan.hester@coloradosprings.gov for those who are listening in virtually. You can email me with questions, even if there's not a project going on and you're just kind of confused and you think, why do we have this regulation in place? Or what does this mean? Or what is this next to my house? That is my role, to serve as kind of this education piece and helping others understand what our process looks like. But also, if there's a project and you're thinking, I don't know if they're really hearing what my concerns are. Maybe I want to appeal an application because I don't feel like it complies with ABC. That is me. So I want to put the plug out there for that. Just now that you see my face and know who I am, that you can reach out to me anytime.
All right. Well, I don't know if you guys can tell, but Morgan actually teaches the history portion of our AICP exam to Colorado prospective AICP planners. So she's got it down pat. Whenever I have a history question, I'm like, hey, Morgan, do you remember this? So I do have some fun animations in our PowerPoint. So if you want to click next, this triangle probably looks familiar. You did see it just maybe 2 minutes ago. But at the very bottom is the comprehensive plan. So that lays the foundation, the vision, the goals, those really high level framework things that then we build on from there. And for the city of Colorado Springs, that's Plan COS. So Plan COS is our community's plan for the physical development of Colorado Springs. If you go through that, it does have 6 vision themes that all those goals and strategies are centered around. And that includes vibrant neighborhoods, unique places, majestic landscapes, renowned culture, strong connections, and a thriving economy. So those hit the 6 main topics that then we build on from there. The very first line of the vision statement for Plan COS is that we will build a city that matches our scenery. And if you have kept up to date with State of the City address, or many speeches from our mayor, John Southers, he uses this line a lot. And so a lot of those vision themes kind of help build on that concept.
With the pyramid that we had, the first level being comprehensive plan, which magically changed to Plan COS, because that's the comprehensive plan that we have and use. The next level for zoning, that has changed to Retool COS. So that is an active project. Our comprehensive plan is seen as that umbrella where we're establishing the vision and goals for our city, but they're directed that have been taken from that plan. The very cool thing, and saying this from the perspective of this being the 4th city that I've worked for, something that is very, very impressive about the city of Colorado Springs is after the adoption of our comp plan, it didn't just sit. We actually took action. I hate to use the same word, but they're pursued, okay, what did it tell us to do? Let's get on this. So the comprehensive plan, Plan COS, was adopted in January of 2019. Retool COS, which is one of the 6 directives, kicked off in December of 2019. I know that's almost an entire year, but we really did hit the ground running because we had to seek a consultant, establish what our purpose would be for Retool. The 5 other directives that have been taken, Hannah's going to cover the neighborhood planning piece of it, but others that have come from it are Connect COS, Home COS, Smart COS, and Annex COS. You probably see a trend with COS at the end. And there are other departments who are bringing these forward. So we have traffic engineering, community development. This is not something that's specific to planning because, again, the comprehensive plan is for the city as a whole. So with Retool, I am the project manager for that, mentioning that we currently have zoning established in Chapter 7 of the Code of Ordinances. Well, because we have not looked at really comprehensively updating what the zoning code is in the past 3 decades, we have, here's a word from earlier, Euclidean-type zoning in place. And there are some other things where it's just very outdated. What has been established in Plan COS, our comprehensive plan, the code language that we have in place right now is not reflective of how to make those goals possible. So everything was established with the comprehensive plan. We're not rehashing anything that was established and adopted by City Council with that document. We're making it happen with, okay, this is what the community requested. This is what they want to see happen. Here is the technical language to make that happen. If you want to stay involved in Retool, this is the website that you can find on the city web. And for those who are listening, but also for the crowd here, so that you don't have to take notes if you don't have anything with you, which I recognize not everyone does. If you go to the city website, at the top, there is a bar for the different departments. Drop down to the planning department. When you click on that, the left side of the screen will have some links. So there's checklists and applications, Plan COS, Retool COS. So it's the 3rd link down, and that will take you to the main webpage. If you want to be included on the email blast, you can send an email to retoolcos@coloradosprings.gov and can get added into the list serve for that. And we will never, ever, ever share your email address. When email blasts are sent, everybody is blind copied, and there's many hundreds of people on there. So the project has been going on for 2 years at this point, and we are coming to the end, which which is very exciting. It's still in its draft form, so it's not totally finalized yet. But with the code rewrite, we hired on a consultant. They are Clearing Associates, and they've worked for many jurisdictions across the country. Something that I really, really appreciate about them is whenever we were going through the interview process, trying to figure out who we were going to hire as the consultant, the main question that they focused on was, what do we need to be aware of with working with the Springs? And I said, and I'm, for those who've maybe heard this presentation before, I'm really proud of myself that I thought of it so quickly. My point was, we have multiple communities within the city, and we need to be sure that we preserve the character of each. We have some very eclectic areas. We have areas that are suburban. I mean, everyone has their opinion and where they want to live, but we need to be sure that that is kept in place. We are not looking to scrap what we've already got, the development pattern. We're not trying to make a mini Denver. We are who we are, and we want that to remain. We're looking for, again, the technical backing, the language necessary to implement the goals that were established with Plan COS. That is what we really need. And they, okay. So whenever there's language that is proposed, maybe we don't love it, and we're able to take the liberty of saying, thank you so much for your suggestion, but it's not going to work here. So we're able to make those changes. But with this project, rather than just starting to write it, because it would have been just the biggest undertaking and virtually pointless to do it that way, it was broken up into three modules. So focusing on the zoning districts and their uses, development and design standards, and administrative procedures. What we're in right now is kind of this limbo between the consolidated draft and final draft, compiling all of that language together as we've gone through public process and various presentations about it. This chalks up my list to being the 68th presentation that I've given publicly on the project. So we've been doing a lot of work in trying to just like push this out and have everybody aware of the goals are established. We're working on making that happen now. So hoping that this will, I don't want to say hoping because I don't want to manifest that. It will be adopted in 2022. And then the next piece, so that will be the text amendment, and that will be adopted through city council. It will go through public hearings prior to adoption. The next piece is the zoning map amendment, because we are proposing changes to some of the zoning districts. Some will change, some will remain. And then the next piece is implementation. So a lot of that will be the public education piece. So it is not going to be done after that text is adopted. And also wanting to, once it is adopted and it, we work with it, if changes need to be made, that is okay. And it's not anything to be embarrassed about. We take amendments to city council and make changes as necessary, because there are some things that we want to be able to try, things that we think will work for what, you know, again, what's been established with Plan COS. If it doesn't work, it's okay. It's not something that this is how it will be forever and ever. And again, if you want to stay updated, you can send your email to that email address.
Neighborhood plans are kind of my baby. I feel very proud to be a part of this program. It's really exciting. It's new for the city. So neighborhood plans kind of rudely insert themselves in between Plan COS and Retool COS in this triangle that we have going. So like we've talked about, Plan COS is that umbrella document that sets those very high level visions. And Retool COS is when you get into the nitty gritty of exactly what the code says in order to implement those visions. But neighborhood plans are somewhere in between. So the neighborhood planning program, which is one of those six directives out of Plan COS, break the city down into 12 geographic regions, and basically breaking down each region or each council district in half. And we hone down Plan COS in a way that's meaningful to a specific neighborhood. So right now we're working on a couple of plans. We have District 4 broken down into two plan areas and so on down the line through all the council districts. But like I mentioned, the goal is to break down Plan COS into that practical neighborhood level manner, so that it has the ability to address those unique characteristics between different geographic regions and specific neighborhoods, but also can further direct the trajectory of those areas in a way that residents feel is positive.
Give me your name. I forgot to ask for introductions. How long you've lived in the area, and now I want to know where you live on this map. Okay, so I'm going to say, Shelley, I've lived in the area for 4 years, and I live in 1A over there in Pleasant Valley, Garden of the Gods.
Hannah Van Nimwegen, I also live in 1A. I live in the Mountain Shadows area. I've lived in the Mountain Shadows neighborhood for just 2 years, but I've been in Colorado Springs for about seven.
So, Morgan Hester, I have lived here for 5 years, and for 5 years minus 3 months, I did live in 5A. I was between Middleshooks and Divine Redeemer, but now I'm in 5B in Wausau, obviously for 3 months.
So like I mentioned, this is just our preliminary boundary map. This is not set in stone. This is not a codified document. This is just what we're using to kind of get us started. So as we enter different areas of the city, that's one of the main questions that we're asking is, well, what do you call your neighborhood? Or do you recognize these as informal boundaries? We decided to go with these 12 geographic areas because the city overall has over 70 neighborhoods. And 70 neighborhood plans is a little bit difficult to manage, let alone produce. So we clumped them together by council district where there's a very clear lead that you elect as a city council member. But then also, if they have very similar characteristics between each of these areas or between your neighborhoods. So if you look at like the 5A area, for example, that's the city's most historic neighborhoods. And if you look at the 3B area, that tends to be very wooded, estate type homes, and so on down the line. They have very unique characteristics. But also, we need to recognize the uniqueness within the neighborhoods within a specific area. So like 3A, there's a very vast difference between neighborhoods. There's Stratton Meadows, which looks very different from Gold Hill Mesa, which looks very different from the Mesa neighborhoods. So these are all things that we're trying to bear down Plan COS into that neighborhood-specific manner. So the timing and order of neighborhood plans would be based on a specific set of criteria that we established and presented to the City Council about a year ago. We really feel that these neighborhood plans are best, will most effectively help areas that are seeing a lot of change, that are seeing transition between land uses, that are seeing redevelopment, infill development, that have low to moderate income census blocks, that have very high engagement from the community, and have any recent or ongoing studies, assessments, analysis that we can kind of piggyback off of that recent information. So all these pretty colors tell us that the more intense the color, the higher it scores in a particular criteria. And again, when this is emailed out to everybody, you'll kind of see how this breaks down. But if we go to our next slide, this highlights the areas that came up as top priorities for this program, the areas that we will address first. However, our goal is to eventually get a neighborhood plan for the entire city, but it may just make more sense to address these areas as priorities. And so those break down as plans areas 4A and 4B. So we would consider that Southeast Colorado Springs. It also is Plan 3A, so the older areas of the west side of the city. Plans 5A and 5B, again, those historic neighborhoods, but 5B also seeing a lot of infill and change in land use that we can help influence. And 1B is also that original suburban development that came in the 1950s when that Euclidean-style zoning really exploded. And it's also starting to see some infill and change, especially around UCCS and how that's affecting neighborhoods. What are these neighborhood plans? What are you doing? What are you talking about? These are land use focused plans. So the goal is to identify vacant properties that are prime for development or properties that are prime for redevelopment. It's easy to identify those, especially when there's a high land value but a lower building value. If that land value is high, it means that the location is good. The market may see a very prime use for that. And so how we can affect those things through these neighborhood plans is that when they're adopted as a master plan, through a community-led process, we can say our preference is that this particular site develop in XYZ way or with XYZ land uses. And when planners who do development review get an application for that particular site, they'll reference these neighborhood plans and make a recommendation based on that. We also look at a number of other things besides just land use. I do like to consider these basically clearing houses for a specific area of town where we look at transportation planning, economic development, public safety, housing, homelessness, and just a series of different topics that may be important to a particular neighborhood. But one of the emphases that we are really proud of is our healthy community planning component. So we are looking at establishing or creating health assessments for each area of town that would look at the health of residents, the health of the environment, and things that we can do to influence the built environment to improve whatever particular factor that may need to be improved with a particular area of town. So the one that we are working on right now is the southern portion of Councilor Avila's district. That's Plan 4A. And we produced a health assessment for that neighborhood, and it came up with some things that we already knew, and it came up with some things that we thought were really interesting. And so we're currently drafting language for that plan now. We're working very closely with Councilor Avila, the community, and community leaders to produce those recommendations. And so when development comes into an area, once that neighborhood plan is adopted, and I'm going to follow Morgan's lead seed and say it will be adopted in 2022. Then we'll be able to use it as a master plan to help guide future development and change in projects and resources to influence the 4A area as the residents want to see. And the next one is going to be 3A. So we are, like I mentioned, drafting language for 4A. So we're kind of coming to a close with drafting that language, and then we'll fling it out to our steering committee for 4A, make sure that has the seal of approval there, and then we'll kind of fling it out to the public and say, all right, is this what you would hope to see? Is this right? Is this wrong? Are we missing anything? Things like that. And while we're going through that process, we'll be kicking off the neighborhood plan for 3A. So a lot of data gathering, analysis or preliminary analysis on what that data may be telling us, and starting to talk to the public about what they would hope to see in their area. We haven't formally kicked off Plan 3A yet, but we are having some preliminary discussions with our consultant. So 2022 will really be the year of Plan 3A and also part of 2023.
What does all of this mean for the growth of Colorado Springs?
So what does all this mean? Everything we've talked about.
So obviously we have a lot of plans that are in place, things that are in motion right now, things that are in the works of being implemented. So hopefully now that Hannah and I have kind of explained what our focuses are on, it makes sense as to why we don't do development review. We wouldn't, not that we just wouldn't have time, but she and I are more focused again on the long-range planning aspect and policy of how everything is enacted and regulated in the city. So we recognize the fact that there's been a lot of development and a lot of change. Our department has seen, since the beginning of the pandemic, I think that everybody had kind of the same fears for those people who were employed, that everything is going to stop. I'm not going to have a job in a week. What's going to end up happening? For us, things just got so much busier, and there was a lot of stuff that had been in the pipeline in terms of development, things that were already financed. So nothing really slowed down. If anything, it got way busier. Our department was able to hire on 6 more planners. That was approved by City Council because with the amount of work that was coming in, plans for review, things that she and I are working on and others on our teams, the acknowledgement that, oh, wow, Colorado Springs is very, I mean, we all know because we've lived here, the Springs is a very cool place. There's a lot of character and different pockets of things that make a specific area, very, very special. And that's why we live in our different neighborhoods. And what can we do rather than just, yep, it's busy and it's going to continue? What can we do to ensure that the way things are planned and what we are approving and how we are approving them makes sense for what are, again, that overall vision and goals that have been established? How does that plug in to what's been approved by City Council? We're seeing a lot of these plans come in, again, with the work that she's doing with neighborhood planning, that, again, the recognition that things are changing. We have infill. There are properties that are being bought, along Academy, or the hope that they will be bought, because we've had some buildings that have been vacant for quite some time. And, mentioning that we have that list of books and how planning works from the theoretical side, that is where our jobs come in, that, okay, we see an opportunity. This is very, very exciting. What can we do to impact that? And so that's kind of what she and I, thus far, what we've been focusing on. But I mean, the future and what does all the growth mean? There was something that was put out that now college-age students, that it's really popular to move here, which is a good thing for the next generation to continue the life that's in our community. That's just one thing. And
when we talk about the growth of Colorado Springs, I think it's important to note that there's two different types of growth, that we have growth out in the Banning Lewis Ranch area or out in the outer edges of town. And so like the picture on the left, that's a recent photo of Banning Lewis Ranch, where it's kind of out in the prairie. But also we need to look at growth that's happening within the established and developed areas of the town already. There's a lot of change happening. And so the picture on the right is actually a photo of Chapel Hills Mall as of December, where there's a lot of new construction happening, demo of the Sears. There's going to be a new apartment complex up there. And that's happening all over town. It's not one specific area. So when we talk about growth, we're talking about new development or greenfield development out on the outer edges, but also change change in the city's boundary. Everything that we've talked about today all kind of feeds into how we should contemplate growth for the city, right? We have Plan COS, which is a large guiding document. We have Neighborhood Planning Program, which kind of hones in that really large scale document into a neighborhood specific level. And then we have Retool COS, which is the specific codes and ordinances that get us there. We also want to touch on annexation and annex COS. So annex COS is the city's, or it's not adopted yet, but it's being worked on, the city's guide to annexation into the future. There is an annexation plan now. It is kind of aging. You know, it's been around for 15, 20 years now. And so things are just different than they were 20 years ago. It's time to update it. The state does require some level of annexation plan for all incorporated municipalities. So it is required that we have an annexation plan. We're just updating ours because it's, you know, things are different. So the 1980s were really the heyday for annexation so far. We do have a cool little video that shows how that's all played out. But the rate that we're seeing annexation today is not nearly what we saw in the 1980s, if you can imagine that. Most annexations right now are occurring to the north and to the east of the city's boundary. So if we're thinking about the Northgate area and even east of Banning Lewis Ranch, that's where most of these annexations are happening. But also, we're slowly annexing pieces of internal to the city. So what we call county islands. Those are property by property starting to come into the city's jurisdiction. One important point that I think we should also consider is that annexation is not necessarily, or is not to be confused with growth, because we have two governing bodies in this region. I should say for Colorado Springs, if we think about it informally. So we have the city of Colorado Springs. We are an incorporated municipality with our own government, but there's also El Paso County, and El Paso County has their own planning department, and they do very similar things to what we do in the city. So whether development occurs or not is not dependent on annexation. So if we choose not to annex a property, development can still happen with the county. It is the city's desire to annex properties that are going to develop so that they pay their fair share of taxes. When a property develops in the county, the property is probably using Garden of the Gods Park just like everybody else is. It's probably driving on the same roads that everybody else is, but they're not paying the same taxes that somebody who's in the city's jurisdiction are paying for those services. So that's why when development is coming in, it's important that we try to annex it so that they pay the same amount that others do. So between 2013 and today, there's been a little bit of annexation to the north and to the east and filling in some of the county island area, but the 1980s were really the heyday of when the city really formed its current boundaries. So according to data that was recently gathered, and or I should say that was gathered 2 years ago and we're just now seeing, the census reported that the city's mean center of population continued to move northeast. So in 1990, it was kind of, I would say, a little bit north of the downtown area. And then in 2000, it made a significant jump northeast to that near Palmer Park. And then 2020, it seems to be land right in the middle of Palmer Park. So if we had a crystal ball, what is all this telling us about growth for the city? If I could make a speculation, and then Morgan, if you feel comfortable, I would say that that trend continues, that it continues to move north and east, and that we continue to see annexation to the north and east, and that the population continues to grow.
And I agree. You know, on the west side, we have some boundaries that cannot, we're not going to develop Pikes Peak or those kinds of things. So we have a really clear line to the west and also south of us. I mean, there's also other smaller jurisdictions. So when you get north, northwest, you have USAFA, Monument, and then there's county line. So there are some things, again, those parameters where we can't really do all of that out that way. But then when you look at the east, we do have a lot of space, and that's where new developments have been occurring within areas that have been annexed. Because again, the annexation is separate from the development. But we're seeing, you know, I mentioned that the stat that I saw yesterday or the day before about college age students wanting to move here. When I first moved here in 2014, there were not really that many people within my age category. And something, again, that we've seen with the census data, there, it's a younger population. population wanting to move here, which is a positive thing because when something is established, you want for it to carry on into the future. So focusing on that sustainability aspect of what are we doing right now and what will this look like in the decades to come for the people who are moving here? There's been a lot of migration from other states, and that has definitely impacted the way that we're thinking about these plans and policies that we're working on. But yes, for sure, up to the north and the east. And a lot of that is because there's available space there. But also I think that there's becoming a shift in the mentality for infill development. So things that are currently in place. So Hannah mentioned the Chapel Hills area. We have a lot of commercial properties that have just kind of sat for years and years and years. And from our perspective, it's a good thing when you have someone come in and they want to redevelop those properties. Also from the sustainability aspect, it's a positive because the infrastructure is already in place. So there's not it doesn't necessitate having to pull new water, having to pull new wastewater, all these utilities extending out. It's already within the city and just redeveloping and having kind of like a shift in the mind frame of what makes sense here is also reflective of the people that are moving in, and we have that in migration. So Hannah and I have lived in different places within the city and we've moved kind of recently. So there is that shift that we've got internally.
Yeah, and I appreciate that you brought up infill because there are those two types of growth, right? So there's growth that's happening to the north and to the east, but as properties age and that land value is still there, there is going to be changes in land use. There is a natural neighborhood life cycle that generally spans about 50-ish years before there's just a desire for something different. The consumer tastes change, the way things are built. There's also aging structures and aging infrastructure. So it's natural to have places redevelop. And I think we'll see those areas that were really developed in the 1950s turn over and become something new, or an old structure be replaced with something new too.
So with what we're mentioning, that is reflective of Plan COS. And then with Retool COS, how do you make that happen on the ground? Because the way our code is written right now, we don't really have much flexibility with if you want to have some sort of redevelopment or a mixed use type development. So the way that a lot of the older neighborhoods were developed, not all of them, but this goes for a number of them. So Middleshooks, where I lived until 3 months ago, there's little corner commercial developments that are more of a neighborhood scale. You can walk to them. There was one place that my husband used to get his hair cut. He could just walk down the street, get his hair cut. We could walk in the other direction, get some pizza. Those kinds of things, if anybody were to make that request today, we don't have what we call a hard zoning district that's possible. Hard zoning means a commercial district, a residential district, because again, it's Euclidean. So if someone were to come in, they would most likely have to submit what we call a planned unit development, a PUD zoning. I simply put that as create your own zoning district because we just don't have the mechanism in place to make those things happen. So with Retool, there's a shift, and it's very exciting that, you know, presenting this information and then city council's like, that sounds great. That's very, very exciting because we're kind of shifting back. So in one sense, we're seeing that, oh, in the future, we need these things. But we're also thinking back to what we historically had in place before. I don't know what ended up happening. So this is not blaming anyone. Before those developments were removed and we can't get them back because, again, we don't have the zoning in place to make it happen. So with mixed-use zoning districts where it allows for, you know, maybe we have some sort of residential component, but then there's also neighborhood scale, a coffee shop or a small boutique or something that you can have within your neighborhood within walking distance. I think that those things, you know, having the mechanism in place so an applicant can look at it and say, I would like to do that. Okay, then you can submit your application and we can review it. That those things will be more prevalent in the future.
So who decides on the policies related to growth and annexation? We as city planners, we study this stuff and we can provide the best insights and best knowledge that we have possible, but we don't make overarching decisions that are related to how a city moves forward. And that really lies with our elected officials. So that being the city's mayor, the city's city council, as well as the county. We talked about the county. They develop properties too, and that's the county commissioners. And we kind of went over this. We cannot emphasize the role of local politics in all of what we're talking about today. Who we elect to our city council, to our mayor, to our county commission plays heavily on the topic that we're talking about today. So everything we've talked about comes from our knowledge and background and our studies, but all we can do is inform. That's our role as city planners that work for the government. We inform and they make the decisions.
Kind of like the League of Women Voters. We inform and the voters make the decisions.
Yes, exactly. So this is the perfect group to talk about this with, but if you don't like something that's happening, you need to advocate with your local politicians, because we're not saying that you can or can't develop a specific property. It's all of the regulatory framework that's decided on by people higher than us. And that's it.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Appreciate the presentation. And I think a lot of our guests are here to ask some questions, so I know we're going to want to open it up. So thank you, Morgan. Thank you, Hannah. Thank you, both of you. All right, so we're going to open it up for questions. We got about 40 more minutes left. Okay, so speaking on growth, I'm going to go ahead and ask this one because Judith mentioned specifically about police and firefighters. The area of the city of Colorado Springs is approximately 196 square miles. That sounds correct. There are 22 fire stations that are operating at around 62% of staffing capacity. With planning, are we, with your planning, Plan COS, with all of that, are we planning accordingly with regards to incentives to fill? I mean, this is not your jurisdiction or anything like that. Here we are not even filling what we have, and you know, thinking of the future, are we planning and accommodating for that type of growth as well?
When we get a new development in, police and fire are absolutely considered.
They're on that green sheet that gets a notification.
They get it before the green cards get places.
That's right, because we get a notification on that says who got it, right, in that document?
Right. When a new development comes in, we have what we call an LDTC meeting, so short for a Land Development Technical Committee. This meeting happens before an application's even submitted. Public safety is at that round table, as well as stormwater, engineering, city planners, landscape architecture, parks. It's a group of schools. Like 30 people.
Schools are involved in that as well.
They communicate at that stage whether land is required to be dedicated or fees are paid in lieu. So it depends. It's a case-by-case basis, but police and fire are absolutely considered. And I would say most of the growth that we'll see in the next 20-ish years will be out in the Banning Lewis Ranch area. When that area was annexed in the 1980s, they identified specific spots for police stations and fire stations. And so as that area develops, it was thought of at that time, but maybe needs are different. Maybe it needs to move or shift a little bit. So those are all conversations that we have prior to an application coming in.
And I know that's not your field of expertise, so that's okay. I totally get that. So we don't even have to talk about it.
There is another piece of the staffing aspect of that. I've talked to planner friends across the state and the country. There's a big shift of people leaving, specific to local jurisdictions, leaving where they are and moving to another. So there are a lot of shortages in different departments. And of course, not being an HR person, but I know enough to be dangerous-ish with whenever we're hiring. We have had vacancies in our department since the beginning of the pandemic. And there's a lot of, we're trying to get caught up. You know, of course, the way that things are funded, some through development, but making those changes, requests to city council that when we have more development, we need more staffing for this or for that. And that's through the budget. Again, totally separate from our department, but just a little nugget.
Okay. Dave, go ahead.
If the city of Colorado Springs population were to stop growing and just stay stable for a long period of time, would you characterize that as success or failure, good or bad?
Well, that I would follow your question with a question. What would be the reason that there is no growth? Because then that could determine the success. Or I wouldn't necessarily say a failure, but in this hypothetical scenario, why is there no growth?
Let's say that Colorado Springs had grown enough that it was just as unattractive as all the other places in the country.
Okay. You know, something that Hannah and I talked about before today was there are other jurisdictions within the state that, Boulder being one, who have implemented growth boundaries and growth restrictions. And there are some good things to that. You're able to kind of focus on what you already have on hand. What does development look like? But then there are some negatives that are the result of that. The cost of housing skyrockets. Wanting to do any new development is just not financially feasible. goal. So there's good and bad. I wouldn't want to say that it would be a failure unless everything just totally falls apart. Do we still have a government in place? And it's not an apocalypse, so I would assume that we would. But there are a lot of contributing factors that you could argue both positive and or negative, depending on what the situation is. From the standpoint of being a government employee and knowing how much work we have, if there was a little pause, that would be really neat, because then maybe we could get caught up on some stuff. But, you know, whatever mechanism it is, again, going to what other cities have in place, the growth boundaries or restrictions, moratoriums, whatever that looks like, and being the reason for a little pause.
I would agree with you. I think that there's absolutely positives and negatives, and it would definitely hinge on why that pause is happening. So if we're putting a pause to get caught up, I mean, I would in favor of my personal workload. But if the pause is something that wasn't expected or we didn't plan for, then that could have potentially some impacts, but it's hard to speculate exactly. I feel like I'm making uninformed speculations
right now.
Well,
and you know, I mentioned early on that whenever the pandemic first started, there was a lot of fear that we thought, oh my gosh, we're all done for. We're going to have to go home. We're not going to have jobs anymore, because there really was this thought that everything was just going to stop. So from that perspective, and that was truly uninformed fear and just panic of the unknown, thinking that nothing's going to happen. But there was a lot of stuff that had already been, you know, entitlements had been approved, financing was already in place. So it did continue on.
Go ahead. And Judith, you're up. Would you mind coming over to the microphone so I can get you on record, please? Thank you.
Is the growth of Colorado Springs a metric of success? Is that a metric you use for whether the city is successful or not?
With Plan COS, there were specific indicators that were adopted in that document. And there are a series of data sets that don't necessarily say, is growth happening or is it not happening, but what is the growth? What type of development are we seeing? And I would say that's the indicator, is the type of development that we're seeing. Is it a development that's desired by residents? Is it like affordable housing? Is it changes that, I keep bringing it back to residents because that's really where the document was informed from, but is it the type of thing that people were hoping to see when they talked about their high-level goals and visions for their neighborhood? And in that way, I would say that growth is good if it is reflecting those things, and especially if like an old shopping center that's mostly vacant is being torn down so that it can be a new lifestyle center where it's kind of some apartments, kind of some cool little shops and things like that. So yeah, I would say Plan COS does speculate on what type of growth is good, and we do our best to follow that.
Ms. Judith, yes, ma'am.
A potential reason for growth to stop is water, and having gone to the county and listened to the water plan from 3 years ago, and then more recently, their first ever master plan. The water plan actually says at the end that growth cannot continue at the current rate or the county will run out of water. And as someone who follows the water issues, it seems to me like that's a real possibility, a real and very scary possibility. I just wanted to throw that out as the potential way that the growth might stop. But I really wanted to ask, because ironically, women's group I belong to just had a big talk on zoning. And one of the things that she focused on was that historic thing that was mentioned of New York City. And the New York City zoning, that she explained it, was specifically on the basis of shading and view. That is really interesting to me, because personally, I think that my friend General Palmer put Colorado Springs here because of the view. Do we have anything that's in retool that does anything to protect the view and the view corridors, or that protects especially residences from shading? I'm a gardener, and one of the things that's really, really frightening is when people put up second and third stories and totally cut off the sun to their neighbor's yard. Do we have any protection for the view, for protecting sunshine, if one has it, in retool?
So to further expand on the New York, having skyscrapers, that's where that came from. So it is a little different than what we have in Colorado Springs. We do have something written in for buildings that are five or more stories have to provide a shadow study whenever they apply. So that's something that's new in retool. But specifically calling out view sheds, we do not have that, nor do we have it in current Chapter 7.
What other questions do we have? Yes, ma'am. Christine, you have your microphone.
Well, it's probably a utilities question. But when I go around and see the changes that happen in my downtown areas, that's the older part, is that utilities, like how we got our electric signal or our phone line, back in the day there was a phone line, you still see some of this infrastructure infrastructure around. Do cities in general, do they ever take on that project of cleaning up the infrastructure that's just left there?
That's a really good question. So there, in some jurisdictions, there is a shift to burying. Let me back up. So there are telephone boxes, those beautiful green boxes that you'll see in the corner of someone's lot. Because yes, telephone lines and all of those things that were put in, they're the pattern of development for older neighborhoods. If there's an alley available, typically would have had all of that infrastructure in the back. So it's not showing up in the front. Something that we saw in the windstorm, which unfortunately happened, and I am one of the people who had no power for 4 days. And for the areas where that happened, utilities were above ground. For the areas of town that didn't have any impacts, they were most likely buried. And there is a push in some jurisdictions to bury some of that infrastructure. It's extremely costly. So looking at, okay, how do we budget for this? How do we plan ahead? Because utility companies do have their own infrastructure plans, and it's very I'm glad that you bring this up, because I'm going to do some more little planning history. Comprehensive planning is focusing on that overall land use and how things are done. But in a comp plan, you can also have utility plans, transportation plans. And part of that can be, we recognize the aesthetics of this, it's not very sightly. What can we do to impact that? And moving them underground, or requiring that if new infrastructure is put into place, they comply with some design standards, which we did implement in May 2020, took forward a new code for telecom. And we require that if you're doing something that's within the right of way, so that city property, that could be like the sidewalk or the road, obviously, if you're locating a telecom facility on a light pole, so that's referenced as a small cell facility used for our cell phones. It's more of like the pedestrian level type thing rather than the unsightly giant cell towers that are on private property. We have aesthetic requirements for that, saying that you need to house everything within one pole, or, you know, don't have what we kind of lovingly call tombstones, those telephone boxes that are on the ground. A lot of this shift, the part that we can affect change with, because there are some higher requirements in that example that I gave, their FCC requirements at the federal level that we can't really touch. So there are a lot of factors that come into play, but I love that you presented that question, because yes, there are things that can be done. Of course, a lot of it is a matter of how much money do you have for that, but newer developments will most likely bury a lot of those lines so that they're not just overhead and visible.
That's a really good question for Colorado Springs Utilities, because, I guess I should say also, I guess would that phone company be in charge of phone boxes?
No.
See, we're trying to figure it out up here to figure it out for you.
If they're going to make the application, that would be something that we would have to go to them directly. But yeah, it is a question more for utilities that, hey, what does this look like? We know, what mechanisms are in place, but they would be the ones to do that. It's not anything that Morgan and Hannah could really, we could try and talk to our buddies over there, but.
Yes, ma'am. Miss Molly.
I'm going back to the ice cream situations and the application for the fourth ice cream on the corner, ice cream parlor, and that there was nothing anybody could do if they meet all the requirements. Now, is that typical for any commercial, or is it, what determines when you can have input into a variance or a situation and when you just have to take it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I like that the ice cream example really stuck with you. So it would apply for any zoning. So it could be, the seventh factory in a row. It could be the seventh house in a row. It really anything that's, yes. No, it doesn't. It could be any use type, any zone district. So the way zoning is typically going to work in land use is more of an amoeba, like this is where we want to see this type of use. Zoning is very parcel specific. And whenever you have properties that are zoned, it's going to be contiguous lots will be zoned similarly. And there will be a natural transition. Hopefully that's what it is, that you have low density residential, something that's higher density. So multifamily, commercial. So it's that like a logical transition, answering the first part of your question, that it would be for any zone type. If there's a request that comes in and it's just so saturated that oh, we have another one of these, which there are some use types that we are seeing. Oh, we got another one. Whenever we planning staff, again, I'm not doing that, but just saying that as we, my department, are reviewing those applications, it's based off of the criteria that's in our code. So they've proposed something. Is the use permitted? We have a use table and it shows the specific zone district and everything that could be developed in that district. There are some uses that are permitted by right, which means depending on the situation, you could come in with a development plan, or if there's already a building in existence and there's parking available and it's the same, they could just pull a building permit. But what we're doing the review upon is, again, if it's a new building, what does the building footprint look like? The parking, has everything been provided based on that specific use? Landscaping, setbacks, utilities, all of those things, grading. Also, we have permitted uses, but we also have conditional permitted uses. So those are things that, you know, it makes sense to be in the zone district, but if you want to make the request, there's an additional layer of review. So beyond us, the planning department, it has to go to City Planning Commission. And the staff will present findings saying it meets code or it doesn't meet code based on this following criteria. So whenever we take anything to the next body up, so Planning Commission, Design Review Board, City Council, we have a pretty robust report that is included to say this is what the application is, this is how they comply, here's all of our findings, and they use that to make their own determination. So the cards are sent out if it's a major application, which is what we call it within our department. If there is a new development plan on a site that didn't have one before, we will send out those postcards to say, hey, there's a new development happening. If there's something that they're wanting to rezone the property, there's a conditional use request. So it meets the use, meets the zone district, but we have the additional layer of review. Or if there's a variance that's being requested with an application, because again, it's not something that staff is going to make that decision. So whenever those requests come in, even if it does fully comply, still showing up and, you know, either at the public hearing or providing comments to say, I don't know if it fully complies with this specific section of code. These things I don't feel like have been met. Voicing that concern to say, oh, I don't know if it really meets this. And the commissioners and or council will listen to your perspective and they will discuss that. So if there is a request that comes in and it meets the zoning, but maybe there's an additional layer on top of it, hey, I recognize that this is permitted in the zone district. However, I'm concerned because they're asking for an additional variance or an additional something. And these are my concerns because of the proximity to XYZ. Maybe it just doesn't fit into the character. This is on, you're proposing, this would not happen, but this is just an example. You're proposing a major shopping mall on a residential street. The traffic is going to be insane. What did the traffic study show? And a traffic study would say, this doesn't make sense. Don't do it. So again, just kind of using that silly example to help make sense of, does that help? Okay, good.
I think Judith, yes, ma'am, come on up to the microphone.
Environment ever have anything to do with the decisions? So I monitor the Air Quality Technical Committee for the League of Women Voters, and one of the things we've been talking about and also talking with CDPHE about it are drive-in and drive-ins and drive-throughs. So I would add to your list of books that are must reading, Fast Food Nation, which hopefully everybody here knows was written about Colorado Springs, and the fact that we have so many young military people here led to a kind of logical thing about a kind of an oversupply of drive-ins, mainly hamburger places. And I'm becoming quite haunted because every other week, Rich Layden has an article about a new chain hamburger place that's coming to Colorado Springs. They get more press than it's really. So just the other day, I was coming back from having my car serviced, and at Dutch Brothers on Nevada, there were 8 cars in line, including blocking the sidewalk, waiting to go up to a little booth that was there. And there must have been at least 8 behind them with a turn lane to go into Dutch. So like 16 cars on Nevada during kind of an early morning. Do we ever look at air quality and those kinds of issues? Could we ever regulate accommodate drive-ins so that they aren't everywhere? Is that a possibility, or do you already?
So specific with the Dutch Bros, our traffic engineering department and division has had discussions with them because the main thing there is they're impeding traffic flow, and having them in the right of way is a safety hazard. So they've met with them multiple times. But when that happens, I would say that you could make a call to the city and say, hey, this is an issue. They are aware of it, but it's a safety concern. At the pinnacle of this, they should not be parking in the right of way. I understand, Judith, but I'm just answering that part of the question from my perspective. If a zoning code has something in place where it precludes drive-throughs, which is a permitted use, depending on the jurisdiction, for us specifically, it does say drive-through, and it is clearly defined what districts they're permitted in. There are some mechanisms that have been proposed that if it's something that is near a residential type development, that the drive-through, the order box is flipped so that it's not causing the nuisance to any adjacent development. But as for air quality, that is not something that's been written in specifically to Retool, but go ahead.
So it's outside of the city planning's jurisdiction. So right now, the Office of Innovation, what used to be the Office of Sustainability and Innovation, but they shortened it, is currently working on an air quality monitoring program. I'm sure you know, Judith, that we're on the borderline of non-attainment. And so they're kicking off in partnership with Denver's Love My Air program to put up air quality sensors all over the city, and specifically adjacent to populations with, or I should say, populations that are vulnerable. So older adults, low to moderate income areas, near schools and things like that. So the city is aware and trying to monitor these things. With the Southeast Community Plan, we're definitely talking about environmental health and air quality as a part of the discussion. It's not necessarily tied to drive-through specifically, but transportation as a larger topic. One of the things that we are measuring in the Southeast Community Plan is density of fast food uses. I'm sure that you've heard specifically Councilor Avila mention that there are only drive-throughs in the Southeast area of town. And we did measure it, and specifically in that particular plan area, there isn't a high density of fast food. However, what it is a lack of other choice. And so when we talk about fast food, we need to also consider, why do we have this perception that there's a huge density? Is it just that there's no other choice to go? So we are aware. We are the Office of Innovation is looking at that stuff, and we also have fast food on the topic list for neighborhood planning. I would say that there is not a national set standard. However, some cities do consider buffer requirements between a lot of things, and fast food may be one of those things.
All right, we've got a few minutes more before we wrap up. Any other questions? Ms. Brenda, all right, I'm going to wait for you. And I'm selfishly going to ask, I got a green card on about the 30th Street Church that was transitioning. Yeah, uh-huh. Went to the meeting, did all that kind of stuff. We had a smaller facility on Crown Ridge that moved in, that bought the property, using it for a rehab. I've talked to a couple people about it. To this date, they still haven't produced a development plan for that home. And it was a transition. For those of you that don't know, because I'm sending this to my people on my email list, the church on 30th Street is doing a variant change. So they're going from one thing, from a church to a different kind of facility where you can go and get counseling and one-on-one assistance for alcoholism or drug rehab. The other one that was never got an application was a residential home right next to a park, very similar situation where they are just out of prison, out of drug rehab, alcohol rehab, whatever, but they're living in this residential home now. It's, you know, they're not in detox or anything like that. It is literally, they're living there. And the entire neighborhood was up in arms because we didn't get that little green card. There was no application. To this day, there still is no application. And the thing was, there's a lot more people living in there. It had to be updated. The home was supposed to be updated for sprinkler systems because there were people living in the home. It was a different type of residential in our community. And my question is, process was skipped.
by the person who bought the home, and they're still living and benefiting in that home, and we still don't have any resolve. So I'm going to probably kind of maybe take this offline, but I guess my question is, what happens to people who don't do the process?
I think I know what you're talking about. We'll talk about it offline because it's an active code enforcement case. But in general, and this is not specific to that situation, but I do want to say that there are some federal housing laws that are in place protecting what we call human service establishments. So there are very specific uses that are allowed in residential districts for like hospice. Basically, if it's a 24-hour care type facility and you're living there and you're functioning as a family unit, there are federal law that they have protections. But with what you're talking about, I think that that's different. And I want to be educated whenever I answer the question. So let's talk about it.
We talked really early on about it, questions. But and you're right, there are laws that protect certain people. And when I went to the meeting on 30th Street and I sent my comments to Gabe, the planner on that one, was specifically, look, everyone was worried that their home values would go down when these people moved in this specific company moved in. It's not about, first of all, you've already got somebody next door to you that's probably already an alcoholic or, you know, recovering from drug rehab. They're literally living right next to you. You may not even know it. So for them to actually be transparent and open about the process is a great thing. And that's not what's going to make your home values go down. It's inflation and interest rates. Yeah, that's what's going to make those things go down. Is so just an FYI for those, it was mostly about fear. And I think a lot of that stuff has to do with fear with regards to compliance. But thank you for being here for transparency's sake for our part as well. So,
and you know, having those neighborhood meetings, that is a huge part of it, that when there are those questions about what does this mean, so that someone can explain it. And that's why, again, I want to encourage everybody that when you have those questions, attend those meetings. If you get a postcard, send an email to the planner, even if it's just to ask a question that I don't understand what this means. Can you help me? The education piece, which is why I love doing this kind of thing. The education piece is so valuable because it's not going to eliminate it, but it does maybe slow things down or diminish that level of, I don't understand, so I'm just going to get angry. And so again, I love this. And you can always reach out to me if you have those types of questions.
All right, Brenda, you got the last question.
So the first one is just a clarification. Those green cards, I heard you say go out for if it's within 1,000 feet. Can you put that in something I can understand? 3 blocks, a half a mile?
It's measured based on a buffer from the subject property. And it's measured from the property line out. And we do that in our office and compile a list of all of those addresses, which is based on the assessor data, and send it out to the property owners.
1,000 feet is about 1/5 of a mile.
So typically a city block is typically 660 feet.
Oh, so it's not even 2 blocks. Oh, less than 2 blocks. So you're saying you pick a center spot and it goes out like a spokes from
the property line.
Mm-hmm. As a crow flies,
basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Shelley, as a crow flies, we have a lot of measure. Thank you for saying that. It's always like stuck here. We have measurements in our code and it's as a crow. We only have one that is direct pedestrian access. Thank you for that. As a crow flies, you just burp, so you jump over the fences and everything else. Thank you for that.
Well, mine is a crossover into utilities again, and I think I heard you say the same word. Judith talked about air quality. Mine is about water. Do you consider with that, if you're asking for 4 car washes or 4 marijuana grows, heavy water users, is utilities involved in that, or how does that process?
Yes. So whenever we have applications that come in, we call it the buck slip process. So the project manager, the planner, will distribute that out to internal and external review agencies. The development review group with Colorado Springs Utilities is one of them. So whenever they are reviewing, they're making sure that, okay, do you have all the infrastructure? Does all this make sense? But then there's a requirement for additional applications made to utilities for water and, you know, all of the hookups for everything. And then at the time, so let's say that something is approved, whenever they go to pull building permits, they're going to pull their tap and meters with utilities, which is an additional fee, a substantial fee. And so that is something that is reviewed whenever those applications are submitted. They have something that they review. Are you doing, let's say it's like a multifamily development. So you have the domestic water for your sink, toilet, showers, cooking, all of that. Is there a dog park? Is there irrigation? What are all these things? So they do factor in all of that in their review piece of it.
All right. Thank you, everybody. We're wrapping up here just a few minutes. Just kind of want to say thank you to our guests, Morgan and Hannah. You guys were awesome. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening and being an active and engaged citizen of our community. If you would like to join our local league, please visit our website at lwvppr.org. Membership is open to anyone over the age of 16 and is free to students. Be a more active and engaged citizen and become a member of the League of Women Voters of the Pikes Peak region. Making Democracy Work is sponsored by yours truly, Shelley Roars, real estate agent. Discipline, hard work ethic, service to our nation. This is the type of realtor you want on your team. Thank you for listening.